The views expressed on this show by guests and the host on issues outside of the 9/11 controlled demolition evidence are the opinions of those individuals alone and do not necessarily reflect those of architects and engineers for 9/11 truth.
Welcome to 9/11 Free Fall. I'm the host, Andy Steele. Today we're joined by Tony Zambodi. Tony is a mechanical design engineer with over 30 years of experience. That's in aerospace and communications industries. He's a member of AE 9/11 Truth, and he was involved in the Remember Building 7 campaign and was on national television, if you remember, with Bob McElvain back in 2010 to talk about the controlled demolition evidence. He also appears in such documentaries as 9/11 Explosive Evidence Experts Speak Out, 7, and The Unspeakable, among many others. And I always like having Tony here on the show, so let's go ahead and add him in. Tony, welcome back to 9/11 Freefall.
Yeah, hi, Andy. It's nice to be here.
Yeah, so now we are on video, so it's sort of like a reboot of the whole show. Exactly. Right. So we just released some footage of you from The Unspeakable. It's like the extended edition, extra footage, and it was remarkable to listen to you talk about this. Just the way the cinematography was done in this film, very professional, and I think this is going to help get our message out and reach new audiences, and every project we do gets bigger and better. Tell our audience, as the guy sitting in the chair being interviewed, what that experience was like for you.
I mean, as far as being interviewed by Dylan Avery for that particular subject?
Absolutely, yes.
Yeah, I mean, it's a subject I've been looking into for a while, so it wasn't, to me, it was, I think Dylan does a very good job as an interviewer, and I guess call it a cinematographer or whatever it's called. I think he does a very nice job. I just talk, it felt natural to me.
How does it feel though? Like when you first became an engineer, did you ever imagine that you would be a leading voice on a topic like this? I mean, it's sort of a rhetorical question.
Of course I didn't. This wasn't something I looked to do or had any imagined in any way, shape, or form that it would occur. And I don't consider myself anything other than somebody that's trying to say what I see to be reality that's not being recognized. Those buildings
exactly
weren't demolished.
Well, you know, the thing is, if there had never been any kind of organized effort among engineers to speak out about this issue, there would have been a lot of people who would have looked at World Trade Center 7, for instance, coming down. They would have said it looked funny, but then it would have died right there, because a lot of people wouldn't have had the knowledge base and therefore wouldn't have had the confidence to step forward, speak out about this issue, be able to cite the facts that you have contributed to, as well as so many others. It's just really amazing, thanks to the power of the internet, that so many people were able to get together and really rally behind this issue. I mean, if 9/11 had happened back in the 80s or something, we would not have had a 9/11 truth movement. So thank you, internet. They're trying to censor it now. It's harder to find 9/11 truth stuff, but we're fighting it. But I think it's too late for them. okay, so let's get a little bit into the evidence here and just talk a little bit about your story, because you've gone toe-to-toe with Zdenek Bezant, I don't think ever in person, but I...
He never responds.
He doesn't seem to like to hear from us.
He's a Stonewall type guy. Well, he has no chance. He can't respond. We wrote a paper, a discussion paper that you're aware of, refuting something that he published in the Journal of Engineering Mechanics. and they refused to publish it, although they published another paper where the person claimed the South Tower was coming down at 4 times the rate of gravity. Well, you can't fall faster than gravity. You can shoot something at a faster speed than gravitational acceleration, or you can't fall faster than that. So, at any rate, the Journal of Engineering Mechanics refused to publish our paper, but they published that right away. And of course, when you have a discussion against the paper they published, the original author gets to respond, and they call that a closure, C-L-O-S-U-R-E. And Bazant wrote a closure. He had a field day refuting this guy, but then they kept our paper, which refuted him, and he apparently couldn't respond. It seems that way. They actually said it was out of scope. I don't know how a paper can be out of scope that is a discussion of a published paper. By definition, that means it's in scope. So that was their answer, and that's being challenged.
Well, it's out of scope of the story that they're trying to push on everybody. And actually, I was going to ask you, because you did publish the paper, The Missing Jolt with Graham McQueen, and it was refuting Bazant's analysis. He came up with that pretty quick, too, pretty soon after September 11th.
No, it wasn't. Actually, Andy, it was not that. No, that was the late 2008 to 2009 before we... what happened there was Graham McQueen was... measuring the antenna, and I part of a lot of my work has been involved with aircraft and dynamics, and I realized that in order to get an amplified load, you need to have an impulse, and that would require a velocity reduction. And because, and the reason you need an amplified load is because in any building, the columns are designed to withstand several times the load above them, at least 2 times. In the case of the tower, because they were so tall, the exterior columns could take 5 times the actual gravity load that was on them, because they had to take seismic lateral loads, seismic and wind loads. So for just the gravity load, that day there was no earthquakes and there wasn't a lot of wind. It was a fairly calm day, September 11, 2001. So buildings are designed to take, the columns are designed to take more than the actual gravity load on them. And it was 5 times for the exterior columns and about 3 times for the core columns. And the only way to defeat that is when you have an impulse, you have the static load plus an amplified portion. And the reason for that, the way to explain that is I use an analogy of a TV stand that can take a 200-pound load, and the TV weighs 40 pounds. And if you just set the 40-pound TV on the stand, it's obvious it's not going to collapse. But if you take that TV and lift it 4, 5 to 6 feet in the air and then drop it on it, you might imagine, just from your own life experience, that it could collapse. And the reason, the scientific reason for that is when it hits, if the stand has any weight, any stiffness to it, when it hits it, the TV decelerates much faster than the rate of gravity. You can decelerate faster. So gravity, 1G deceleration is 32.2 feet per second squared. And suppose it decelerates it, the impulse only lasts milliseconds. So you can imagine, if it decelerates at 30 milliseconds, you're already at 30 Gs. Okay, so... Now you can see that what happens is you have the static load, which is mass times gravity, that's 1 times, that's the 40 pounds, plus that 40 pounds times 30, that's 1,200 pounds. Now you can see how that TV would just smash through that stand. And that's the amplified load you need. But what happens is deceleration causes a drop in velocity. You're transferring energy from kinetic to the impulsive or destructive work that you're doing. So you have to lose velocity, and that can be calculated. And Graham was measuring the antenna, and I asked him to measure the roof line. So he did. And then I took that and did something called the derivative to see what the change in the velocity was. There wasn't, it actually increased. It kept increasing. Well, that's impossible if you have columns that can handle more than just the gravity load of the building, and then it's never decreasing in velocity. That means there was no impulse. Something was actually removing the structural integrity below, and it was just falling through it because it couldn't even handle the static load. So that's actually what had to be happening. And David Chandler, the physics teacher that's famous for proving that Building 7 came down in free fall, for at least the first 2 to 2.5 seconds of its fall, he also measured the roofline and validated what Graham's measurements. And he actually charts it, and he shows it's a continuous increase in velocity as it's coming down. So that proves that it was not an impulsive load. It was not a natural collapse. And
yeah, putting it in layman's terms, I mean, the top block cannot crush the lower block without at least slowing down.
That's right. And, that's exactly right.
That's the easiest way to put it. That's how the audience out there should put it to their friends when they're talking at the bar about this issue. I mean, it just defies common sense. Now, when I said came out with it quick, I'm talking about Besant came out with his theory pretty quick.
Well, 2 days later, 2 days after yeah. the collapses, he wrote he sent a paper to the Journal of Engineering Mechanics. It was called a rapid, it had at the top of that a banner, rapid communication. And pretty quick. And in that paper, he tried to describe, say that it was an impulsive load. It was 31 or 32 Gs. And I actually heard something on the radio or on TV today, a professor, and I believe it would have been Besant, was saying that it was a 20 or 30 G load. Well, that made sense to me. But then years later, in 2007 or 8, when Graham was measuring the roofline, I asked him, I said, well, measure, after I had thought about things, and Building 7 and things like that, I said, measure a roofline. I want to see if this thing decelerates. And sure enough, it did. And then that led us off to writing a paper showing it. Graham very cleverly called it the missing jolt, which is an appropriate name. Because his aunt said in his paper there was a very powerful jolt, and jolt meaning an impulsive load. But there was no energy loss, no velocity change, therefore no energy loss, therefore there could not have been an impulsive load. And you can't defeat columns that can handle more load than what's above them without that amplified load.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, this is all common sense, and you say it very academically there with all your engineering experience, but this is not
something. Well, I just don't know how else to say it, Andy.
This is something that most people can identify with and just intuitively know, just from living in the world. And yet this seems to go over the heads of people trying to argue with us. I mean,
the reason a glass breaks when you drop it, if you just set it on the table, it won't break. It's just a static load. When you drop it on the floor from 3 or 4 feet and it hits a hard surface, it's decelerating very quickly. And that means there's a lot more. If it decelerates at 322 feet per second, that's 10 G's. So now it weighs the mass, it acts like that 10 G's plus the static load, like 11 times the mass of the glass. And then whoever hits it, there's mechanics involved, but it's experiencing 11 times its weight in force. And that's what breaks the glass. So, and
well, what gets me kind of here. Well, what gets me too is the fact that you have, you know, that you're talking about this pile driver, this top block, but this top block disappears in pretty fast.
Well, what actually happens is there's a couple of interesting points here. We'll try to flesh them out. You can help me with your questions if you want.
Sure.
The North Tower, which is what we measured, the aircraft hit between the 95th and 96th floor, like a 10.6 degree angle with the port wing. Well, I'm looking, let's see. If you're looking at the building, it was the right wing was up and the left wing was down. I went into the building and the right wing, maybe 5 to 6 feet of the right wing tip hit the 98th floor because the nose hit the 95th, between the 95th and 96th at a 10.6 degree angle, they say. A little over 10 degrees, and the right wing is up and the left wing is down. So I guess looking at the, I guess the way it was like that. So and to make a long story short, very little of the aircraft hit the 98 floor. That's where the collapse started. In fact, so little of it hit there that NIST didn't even see fit to show any interior damage on the 98 floor in their report. But nevertheless, we get a collapse starting at the 98 floor, where there's no essentially no aircraft damage. And they say fire caused that. But then, on top of that, the next floors to go after the 98th goes, where there's almost no aircraft damage. There is fire, but no aircraft damage. The 99th, 100th, and 100th and 1st go. And I have a theory about why that is. If it's a demolition and you had an aircraft impact and you knew that was going to happen, some of the charges in the aircraft impact area might have been disturbed. Well, how do you defeat that? Well, now you want to have to generate some momentum to transfer to get through it and have an impulse if you need it. And that's why I think those four floors above or so were basically destroyed so that upper eight stories could crush any stories that had some damaged or displaced explosives. And I think they were planted in the core of the building. And there's another thing, too. Go ahead, Andy. What were you going to say?
No, I was just going to say, I imagine that a lot of time and care was put into this operation. It's obviously something, if you're the orchestrator of this controlled demolition, you don't want to screw up. I mean, that would be...
Right. That was a safety measure. Excuse me. That was a contingency measure is a better word for it. And that's what was done because the aircraft might have displaced it. I tend to believe the aircraft were causal ruses. And, the aircraft did it. Oh, it has to come down. Sure. Has that happened before? No. At any rate, there's been aircraft have hit other buildings. They don't come down. Does some local damage. There's another thing I was just trying to think of. We talked about the fact that how would the charges have been planted? There's some interesting things to talk about there, because I imagine people who have been looking into this know that there was the biggest elevator modernization ever undertaken in the Twin Towers, and that's known. It was in Elevator World magazine in March 2001. They were right on the cover. And it was a little known company doing it that Otis, who had designed the system, lost the job, I guess, in the mid to late 90s to this elevator, small elevator company named Ace Elevator. And that's curious because that's a pretty big job. And the two Twin Towers had 99 elevators each. And so 198 altogether between the two buildings. And this small elevator company got that job. And something that sort of confirms that the suspicion there might have some merit is the Empire State Building, which has a 67 elevator system, about 33% the size, a third the size of between the two towers. There was an article in 2011, and there was an interview with them. They put an RFQ out for an elevator modernization of the Empire State Building elevator system, 67 elevator system. And the construction manager is on record saying to an Associated Press reporter that they only allowed Otis, ThyssenKrupp, and Schindler to bid on the job because they felt only one of those three big companies had the expertise to handle a job of that magnitude and scope. Okay, so that's true. And I have a copy of that article, and other people have it also. So it's sort of disconcerting, maybe is the right word, that the Port Authority in New York, New Jersey gave a job of the scope and magnitude of the Twin Towers and modernizing those elevator systems to a small company named Big Sullivan. But also, I have to wonder how they could beat out Otis. I mean, it wouldn't just be cost. There has to be expertise. I mean, you know, you have to be able to, the only people, like the Empire State Building said, the only people they felt that were capable of that job was those three. They wouldn't let, you know, some Tom, Dick, and Harry elevator shop bid on the job. But in the case of the Twin Towers, seems like that was the case. And you could plant charges in elevator shafts unobserved. So if I had to bet, I would say that's how they were. That's how it was done. That was a cover story for planting charges.
Well, I'll tell you what, if and when this whole thing gets busted open and they're doing hearings on C-SPAN, and look, you got to visualize things in order to make them happen. When they're doing hearings on C-SPAN, I will be glued to my chair, not just only because I've been involved with this for so long, but I want to hear exactly how they pulled this off. I want to hear every single detail right down to the colors they were wearing.
Well, there was obviously graft and bribery, things like that involved. I'm sure that this is what we deal with. It's a crime, and you know, people willing to commit crimes like that don't have any problems, I would think, with bribery or graft. I mean, so, you know, the towers were demolished is what it certainly all the evidence points that way.
And, exactly. Now, I want to get back to the 98th floor for a second because, you know, I had this in my notes. I've taken notes on this issue, and it's just this file that keeps on getting bigger and bigger, and that's great when you have a wealth of knowledge like that. However, what happens is you end up forgetting certain details and certain key points of evidence, and it just sort of jumped out at me a few weeks ago, the fact that this only the tip of the wing touched this 98th floor where the NIST says that this collapse initiated. Now, a lot of their story depends on fireproofing being knocked off, and how could this little tip knock off all the fireproofing?
Well, that's right. That's another side of it. And it's right. That's a good point. Because the fireproofing that got knocked off, not only that, it's on the complete opposite side of the building from where the plane hit. The plane hit the north side, but it was the opposite side where the collapse initiated, they said, the south side. And, you know, this it gets a little bit complicated, not a lot, but you have to follow what I'm going to say. This, everything in this report is like anything else. Everything there is not garbage, okay? And I think the aircraft impact analysis has merit to it. And they show at different time frames what the speed of the debris was and the size of the debris field. And don't forget, it has to get through the north side, then through the core, then to the south side, because there was four all around the core. There was a north, south, east, and west side. And the north and south side are 60 feet. So you travel through all that, then through 85 feet wide of the core and all these columns and walls and things like that, all this debris has to travel through. And then supposedly, according to somebody's theory that I don't buy into, but they try to push it, the debris got to the south side and stripped off the fireproofing from the trusses under the floors. And then the fire was able to affect them, and heat them, and cause them to sag and pull the wall in. And that's where NIST stops their analysis. They say that south wall on the opposite side of the aircraft impact sagged enough to collapse, and then that caused the other three walls to collapse. I don't get that either, because a channel is almost as stiff as a box, four-sided box beam. And the chief engineer on the towers, John Skilling, said you could take one wall and two corners, and it would still be able to take 100-mile-an-hour wind because you had the other three sides. And the east and west walls there would give it a stiffness. That's what keeps it from turning. So it doesn't make sense, okay, unless you're not paying attention. And then just to get back to Professor Bazant, I can say one more thing about the aircraft impact that I think is accurate in this report. They tell you what the speed is. And they did some testing. They took a plywood box, like maybe 5 or 6 foot wide, 5 or 6 foot deep and that high. And they put the truss work in there with the spray-on fire-resistant material. And they fired at it with a shotgun, probably a sawed-off shotgun, with a bunch of debris in it, metal debris, like nuts and bolts and things like that. And there was a misfire. It did knock it off when it was doing 500 feet per second. There was a misfire. I don't remember the exact speed it came down to, like 31 meters or like 90 feet per second, and it didn't take any of the fireproofing off. Well, the debris isn't even moving that fast when it gets to the south side of the aircraft impact analysis. It's slower than their misfire. So, you know, like God works in strange ways type thing. Their misfire proves that, you know, along with the aircraft impact analysis, that at that speed that their impact analysis shows it was doing, it wouldn't remove that fire resistant material. So that's just another thing to add to the reasons for doubting this entire story. It's just a lot of things. And what Professor Bazant did was to, he claims that, well, he has the, when it first starts falling, he has it free fall right away, like there's a vanishing story. Okay, well, the 94 didn't get out of the way, even if it did collapse there. It would slowly collapse. It has to bend the columns. Now, he just takes the columns out and has it in free fall. So he also nearly doubles the mass because he used more floors and he used the maximum service load. Well, they weren't loaded to their maximum load. So he used somewhere, in one analysis, he used 54 million kilograms, another one 58. And in reality, it was 31 to 33 kilograms from the 98-4 up. So he almost doubles the mass. And then in free fall, it's moving, that would give you like 8.52 feet per meters per second squared. And when it's measured, you can even see the actual velocity is 6.31. Well, in the kinetic energy equation, velocity is squared. So 8.5 squared is nearly double 6.3 squared. So he doubles the speed component and he doubles the mass component. So now he's quadrupling the kinetic energy. It's making the kinetic energy four times greater than it actually is in this falling mass. And then on top of that, to collapse the columns takes work. You know, column standing straight and you gotta bend it. You know, let's say this is a column, both of my arms. And when you bend it down, that takes work to do that. And there's absorption, and you can determine and calculate what the absorption is of a certain size column. We know what's called the yield moment, the plastic moment. We can calculate that. The work that it takes to do that. Well, he underestimated that by at least three. And that isn't just shown by me. There's a PhD, well-known PhD named Greg Rozulodinsky in Australia that came to that conclusion. And I was worked with him on a paper along with Professor Richard Johns from the university at the time, the University of British Columbia. And we published that paper in a journal in Great Britain called the Journal of Protective Structures, which is a dynamics journal. And we showed that he underestimated the column energy absorption by three. So he underestimates the ability of the columns to absorb energy. And then he quadruples the kinetic energy. And they multiply. That's not just additive, that multiplies. So it's four times three. So he, by a factor of 11 to 12 times, increased the likelihood of collapse, is what Dr. Bazant did. That's what I've been challenging him on. And we showed that in a discussion paper that the Journal of Engineering Mechanics refuses to publish.
Well, if you got to get them, if they get to the point where they're censoring, then you've won to a certain extent. Obviously, you want it published and to have the information out there. It's such a shame listening to you talk about this, because your average person wouldn't pick up on all of these things that Bazant got wrong. I mean, there's the intuitive aspects, you know, the top block can't crush the lower part without right. slowing down. People know that. But then there's these details that you get into that your average person is not going to know when they're recovering from 9/11, watching the television and some engineers coming on television and
I can understand if you drop the glass on the floor and it just goes through the floor, something's wrong. That's sort of what was done.
Right. And also, I mean, the concept that you can't fall, you know, unless you're shot out of a cannon or something straight down, you can't fall at four times the rate of gravity.
Well, that was that.
How much you grind your teeth.
Somebody that wrote a discussion paper was saying that, and it was silly. It was nonsense, right? You can't fall faster than the rate of gravity. You can decelerate faster if you hit something and stop short. That's a different animal.
Yeah, exactly.
But gravity can only accelerate you so fast. It's the rate of gravity in a free fall. It has a limit. Yeah.
Exactly. And something that I actually picked up on when I was writing the book was this idea that, and you can measure the energy that it takes. I'm not going to get into that here, but, you know, for this concrete to turn into powder in midair and for all these steel members to shoot out different directions.
I tend to shy away from that, Andy. And the reason I do is because it's hard to calculate.
It's hard to calculate, but my point is, though, this, and hear me out and tell me if this is valid. You know, just for the layman, you need a hard collision of building materials to create that kind of dust. And NIST admits that the buildings were falling, quote, essentially a free fall. So how do you, you've got a contradiction there.
Well, you're saying that possibly explosives could have caused some of that. Well, it's not true. What I'm talking about is the columns would have to hit the columns. And the reason they would, the columns wouldn't be out of alignment. The floors aren't going to stop things. There would be pulverization in any collapse like that. I'm saying the columns would have been in the way. And it wouldn't miss the columns because even with a little bit of tilt, the columns go and go out of alignment three eighths of an inch. Okay, even at 1 degree, even across that, they only drop back at 1 degree tilt like 3/8 of an inch. And that's about all there was in the North Tower before it started falling completely. And you have 73 million pounds of inertia. Short of some massive lateral load, you know, with 5,000 mile an hour wind, that's not moving. It's going to fall in place, and the columns are going to contact the columns. And that's what would stop it. Once it got going, because of whatever other reasons we were theorizing, you could have natural pulverization once it got going. Okay, so that wouldn't all have to be explosive. I'm not saying it's not absolutely. It doesn't have to be, and that's why I shy away from it. The fact that it doesn't decelerate is, and they would be local collisions. You could have large beams, you know, hitting concrete floors and the gypsum. It was a lot of gypsum also. Don't forget, that would crush up fairly quick, the gypsum in the wallboards. So that's why I personally try to stay away from that. You know, I shy away from it.
Yeah, well, you know, because I had to recreate the Bazant graph that he uses in his paper. And what gets me, and I think I said this a few weeks ago, is that in his diagram, he shows this top block and he shows it crushing down and it goes all the way and then it just sort of disappears, you know, on top of this rubble pile.
Well, yeah, it's amazing what he said. He has like zones A, B, and C, A being the top, and then that crushes a little bit and you have this rubble layer of B. And that lets the top block just right on top of it while the rubble layer does the job and knocks layer C all the way down. I think I have right A, B, and C starting from the top. You got to make layer B, and you need a deceleration to do that, and that's not happening.
Well, plus it doesn't show what we saw. It doesn't show what we saw actually happen in real life, because the stop block disappears pretty quick in the first couple.
Well, that's right. And I told you the reason I think for that is they had momentum to get through the stories where the charges might have been displaced. It doesn't appear at all who were, but that's why that would have been done.
I was just going to say you need a massive government cover-up to make somebody who is this wrong on so many points, so respected. And
I don't like to bash our government in a sense. I think there are some infiltrators, if you will. I mean, the government does good things, Andy. It's hard for me to sit here and bash our government and say it's the whole government. It's part of it, okay? And there are people who infiltrate government that have control of certain areas. And they're not right, and I don't know why they're doing it. I have an idea. Why it's not being revealed, and I think 9/11 unfortunately was done for oil. And I'll say that on your show. If you want to cut it out, you can, but that's what I think it was done for. And the oil companies in our country have a lot of power. Have had.
Yeah, it's unfortunate. And of course, it's not the guy processing your Social Security check.
No, right. And that's why I don't want people. Well, some people, you know, a broken clock can be right twice a day, right? And if you think everything's a conspiracy, and then, you know, we can create damage and other dangers in our country. And we've seen that in recent times, you know, with the vaccines, with Donald Trump, and, you know, it's the deep state. He doesn't give any other evidence besides it's the deep state, you know, claims that the election was stolen. It can be very corrosive, so you have to be careful. And in my mind, I want to see evidence before I say there's a possible conspiracy. Well, I've seen that with 9/11. And I would encourage others not to go into conspiracies without asking for real evidence, not to buy into it.
Well, this is my position on it for me. I mean, I'm so involved here with AE that, like, obviously I'm going to have personal opinions about other things. It's impossible to be a human being and not, you know. You know what's going on in the news and you follow it, but it's like there's those other things that maybe I would sympathize with or whatever. Those things can happen without me. There's already people out there doing that work.
Right, but the things like QAnon, I don't want to – my point is it's sort of like if you're a detective trying to solve a murder, you're not going to go along with some flim-flam, somebody trying to frame somebody, right? The detective has an obligation to see through a frame also, as well as trying to find evidence for a legitimate murder. Same thing with a prosecutor. That's all I'm saying. So I don't want to just broad brush blame the government. I try to be careful with that. And even more so lately, because we can do damage. Now, I'm not saying we shouldn't go after the criminals that committed the atrocities on 9/11, we certainly should. But we have to be careful with a broad brush just blaming the government as a whole. So right. I want our government to reinvestigate this. That's what we want done.
Yeah, absolutely.
That's what we're asking for, right?
When we see obfuscation from NIST, you know, it becomes easy to say, you know.
It's easy to start saying that.
Yeah. And it's a simple thing to say in the moment, but yeah, you do want to be careful because, you know, we have individuals out there who, you know, and each individual is good or bad, and there's probably good people that work at NIST who have no clue. I mean, Peter Ketchum came forward years later.
Right, yeah, he didn't know about it once he looked into it, he said, there's a problem here. And he was right near people that were doing that work, or somebody was, you know, I had heard that, you know, a lot of people think there was a conspiracy behind John Kennedy's murder. I tend to also in that particular case. You know, he has a gigantic hole in the back of his head. It goes back to the left. And the story's telling us he shot from the right rear. But, you know, there were people that didn't know about that. They just didn't know. Peter Ketchum was the same. I had heard what I was trying to think of. I had heard that J. Edgar Hoover actually planted certain people in certain positions before that went down. Now, that's how this kind of thing would be done. Okay, if some certain people were planted in this, then the others around them just assumed they were on the up and up. How would they know? They wouldn't know necessarily.
So that's how there's an aspect of it, too. Like, I remember I worked for an insurance company. I just did customer service, so I just reported what people got their settlements on the phone. But during the training and on the first day, they made this big point of saying about how there was a lot of people who had this company's insurance, I won't say the name, who were killed on September 11th. And even though their life insurance policies were not you know, didn't cover acts of terrorism, they paid it because, quote, it was the right thing to do. Now, with my kind of more cynical mind, I'm thinking, well, because, you know, you'd have been murdered in a PR aspect if you didn't pay this. It would have been horrible. So there's people who say, why didn't the insurance companies question about controlled demolition? I mean, could you imagine if they came out and started questioning the story?
Yeah, I wonder that sometimes. Why don't they?
But a CEO would have been slaughtered for doing that. And there probably would have been somebody.
That's why. Exactly. It was better to just let it go because it's too big. I had colleagues, when I brought this up back in 2008 and 2009, that were saying to me, it's just too big. Okay. They didn't disagree with what I was saying. They just said it's too big. And pragmatically or practically, they're right in a lot of ways. Okay, I mean, we're talking about an issue. We're not wrong. But it is a big thing, and to you'd be sticking your neck, you'd be sacrificing yourself at the altar at CEO at that insurance company. You'd probably be out of a job very quickly.
Right. So that plays into it too. That plays into it as well. You got people who are just protecting themselves and say, hey, look, this is too big. My involvement and me losing my job is not going to do anything about it anyway. I'm just going to stay quiet. I want to get to this point because you made this in the extended interview that we just released. And it was on, I can't remember if it was the North or the South Tower, but you made a point about how two corners.
It was the North Tower. It was the North Tower. And actually it was the Southwest and the Northeast corner.
And okay.
The building, the Twin Towers are 209 feet on a side up to the seventh floor, and then they transition from 19 bigger columns, like 3 foot square columns, to three. Each one of those transition to 3 14-inch columns and 57 a side, and it went in a foot. So it was 207 foot square. So if you take the diagonal, that is about 292 feet. So the diagonal corners, and you can measure this, start to drop in the North Tower within 0.7 of a second of each other. Now, if anybody believes that a fire could be that efficient, I think I said it that way in that film clip, to disturb and upset the structure of those columns that quickly, over 292 feet, you know, four sides of 207 feet a side, you know, I'd like to see it done naturally. I just don't believe it can be done. They fall within less than a second. Those diagonal corners, that building starts coming down. That kind of precision and symmetry is hard to do with something as random as a fire. Because the fire is not all over the building all at the same time. This is an hour. The North Tower is hit at 8:46. This is a 10:28. What's that? 28 and 74 is, you're talking about 102 minutes later. That's what it was, 102 minutes after aircraft impact. So it wasn't like the fuel, which NIST even had to admit was going in 10 minutes. That started the fires. But the fires weren't completely symmetric in the whole building, yet that whole thing comes down. That's another proof that it had to be. There had to be charges in the building.
That, yeah.
And firemen thought that the collapse was had too much precision and too symmetric for it to be natural. Firemen, the senior firefighters said that, and fire engineers, they didn't believe it either.
Well, obviously, there's enough people out there that do believe it, or at least pretend to believe it, to keep the official story alive. What gets me about this is that, you know, you only go up to a certain point of collapse initiation and then they stop. And then, but everything that happened after that collapse initiation is what resulted in the deaths of people down below. Not just that, but the deaths of people who had got cancers and other illnesses.
All that polarization and then the asbestos and things like that were released. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, and so,
and then the fires in the rubble that were burning and causing, it was all kind of, it was a toxic stew, is what I've heard described as in some ways, to inhale, and that's why a lot of those people got different cancers.
Well, and that this fire issue is so relevant now because those people are still suffering as a result of 9/11. Had the airplanes just gone into the buildings and there was a fire and it was put out, all those people would not be sick. So the controlled demolitions of these buildings is still killing people to this day.
Right. There's still effects 20 years later. You're right.
Exactly. So I just want to get your ideas, though, on the fact that they did not go through this entire collapse. It seems like irresponsible is understating it. It's the best word I can come up with off the top
of my head. Well, I think they didn't do it because it was hard to then do. And they just relied on Dr. Bazan. And I told you, he quadrupled the kinetic energy of the upper mass and upper section of the building. And then he underestimates the absorptive energy of the columns by 3 times. So he essentially, it's a factor of 11 to 12. And I say 11 because it's not exactly doubling the mass or the velocity. So it's about 11 times, which is ridiculous on its face. And he couldn't get that paper through any honest situation. He could not get that approved. But he did, and so somebody at the American Society of Civil Engineers is either a fool, or several of them are fools, but I think more likely it's favoritism. Dr. Bazant was an editor. He was the chief editor at the Journal of Engineering Mechanics for a number of years. So he's a favored guy. And they were protecting him with our paper. They didn't even, you know, they don't want anybody challenging him.
I imagine that in the days after September 11th, there's not even consciously necessarily, but there's opportunism going on among people who have the credentials to try to give a hypothesis on what actually happened to these buildings. Most of them are not thinking about pre-planted explosives.
One was
Minister Foot.
Van Romero, who's an explosives expert and explosive engineer at the University of New Mexico. He said it looked like controlled demolition with charges.
Right.
And then he gets grants, and somebody with their hands in the till in the federal government put pressure on him, and he backed off the story. But that's what he said initially. He said it looked like pre-planted charges. He said it, and it's out there that he said it. And he backed off it, and, you know, sort of got mealy-mouthed, and I think somebody threatened his livelihood.
Who knows? But, you know, I mean, Bazant came up with it pretty quick. And I imagine, like, he got it out there, and NIST adopted it, and now there's something for him to defend here.
Dr. Bazant, I don't know. He simply won't come clean on this. He's totally wrong. He won't come clean. And I know he had done work for intelligence agencies before, and I'm not saying all intelligence agencies are bad either. But there are some actors within those and other places that know how to put pressure on certain people. I don't know if somebody has something on Dr. Bazant. That may be true. You know, J. Edgar Hoover, they say, had something on a lot of people. He kept records. They said when he died, there was a scramble. He had a room full of file cabinets, full of, if not outright, material that could really be used, but it was either could even be embarrassing material. Okay, but J. Edgar Hoover apparently used FBI agents to get embarrassing or disparaging information on people, and that may be true here. I mean, this happens with some politicians. You know, Richard Nixon said something a long time ago: when you get a man by you know what's, you know, he'll generally do what you want.
Well, I'll tell you what. I mean, the whole history of politics to ancient times has been dirty, and
there's always dirt in it. There's always been dirt, right?
There's more capabilities to do more now with the internet and with all the surveillance and stuff. And if the wrong people get their hands on other people's information, that's why it shouldn't be out there. Who knows what they're going to do with it? Now, I want to ask you, though, because you are an engineer, and I probably have asked you this on previous shows, but the answer can change possibly with new experiences and such. When you talk to people about this, and I don't mean just people, but I'm talking about other engineers, peers, what in a not a debate session setting, you know, like not when you're debating it, but you're just talking.
Right. I can give you a good. I have a good sample or example of that, that where people didn't know where I work. They don't know. Everybody doesn't know that I work in this. You know, it's just not that well known. So I'm really not. I'm well known to some segment of society, but you know, the people I work with, I'm just a colleague. And Dr. Ostene was on this past because it was the 20th anniversary, and for professional engineers, they have these professional. A lot of states require professional development hours, and they have webinars. And a lot of places, companies like mine, it's a lunchtime, bring your lunch type thing, and you get your company you know, you use a conference room and you watch the webinar. And Dr. Ostene, who was famous for having, you know, looked at the steel and talked about seeing things melting like Salvador Dali paintings, melted steel. But he turned, he said it couldn't be a controlled demolition. And he denied all that. Well, he was on. And some senior people, one guy's a Navy commander, a 77-year-old Navy commander, still working part-time, and others, they didn't like the fact that he just, and he denigrated architects and engineers for 9/11 truth, said some are good people, but they're wrong. And they didn't like us, what us and they did. They said he didn't provide any analysis. They were looking for analysis, and he didn't provide any. And I would think he can't provide any analysis. Because when you do the analysis, it shows they had to be controlled demolitions. I'm not saying it because I want to. I'd rather not say that. I wish I didn't have to say that. But I have to say it because that's true. The science says it had to be.
Well, I've been dealing with a lot of engineers, not necessarily ones that are at AE 9/11 Truth lately. And I find that when I talk to them, they're interested in the topic, but then other forces come in and the kibosh on what we want to do.
Yeah, sure.
So, I mean,
it can't be too forceful. Yeah, it's because it is big.
What I'm talking about is a political issue. Your average rank and file engineer, I mean, most of them will say, yeah, I want to go listen to a presentation on this topic, come over and talk about it, or send one of your engineers over. And then something happens along the chain where, the bigger bodies come in and just stop the entire thing. And I'm just thinking, if it wasn't for these big organizations existing here, most engineers would be interested in this.
Well, they don't want to stick their neck out. They don't want to stick their neck out alone. And that's the divide and conquer principle. And you saw that with the, I think Richard Gage made a little bit of a mistake in all the energy he put into what's the Institute for Architects? The AIA.
AIA.
When you were with me, I came over to see you guys in Philadelphia. I guess it was 2015 and you were there.
Yep.
And, there was a lot of energy put into that. Well, they weren't going to do it because they don't want to stick their neck out as a lone group. I mean, there's a chance, maybe a 0.5% or 1% chance that once they do it, somebody else would. But sometimes everybody else will say, well, all right, you did it. That's good. But then they don't. And you're left there holding the bag. So that's part of it. There's pressure from, you saw what happened with Spike Lee last September. He was going to just show something about this, and he got told it's being debunked thousands of times over. Well, actually, it hasn't been debunked, what we're saying. Can you give us evidence of this? For instance, Zdenek Bazant can't come back with a reply to us, to our discussion paper. Therefore, they have censored it. Mm-hmm. Because he can't. He can only debunk something where it's off the rails. The thing's decelerating downward naturally at 4 Gs. That can't happen. You'd have to have a rocket motor on the top of the South Tower to drive it down at 4 Gs. It's silly on its face. So it's that kind of thing. It's like a straw man was set up for Dr. Bazant. But he wouldn't, and when there was a real legitimate analysis critiquing him and showing he was wrong, they would not publish it.
Well, and they know that the only media that's going to cover a story like that, regarding the fact that this guy's been wrong on so many points here, is this show. This show and other shows.
That's right. You're exactly right. I mean, that's why there's a place for you right now. I think you're a talented guy and can do other things. But this is needed to some degree because it's reality. And we shouldn't let go of something that, 9/11 is still referred to. And it always bothered me when I would hear politicians say, we're going to keep you safe, when some of those people did not investigate 9/11 properly. You want to keep us safe. Tell us what really happened on 9/11. Get the guys that put charges in those buildings. And it wasn't the people flying the airplanes that did that. So
exactly. Well, you know, it reminds me of back on C-SPAN when we were doing that whole thing, and I cannot remember this congressman's name, but he was in California.
Adam Schiff?
No, it wasn't Adam Schiff. No, it was another guy.
Hunter? Duncan Hunter?
It might be it. I don't remember. He got booted out for some kind of scandal.
He was using his campaign funds for luxury vacations. Duncan Hunter.
Yeah, and so he says with a surety when the caller asks him about Building 7, probably, you know, those towers were brought down by Islamic extremists, and that's what all the reports show. And then the host, actually, to my surprise, says, "Did you read the reports by the committee?"
Said, "No, he said, no.
But you're sure of their findings." Says, "Yeah,
I watched that. I saw that. Yeah, that was funny."
It's funny, but it's a tragic issue. So I feel
it is tragic. No, it's funny in the sense of it's ridiculous. He said that, and the host showed what was funny is the host, and you got to give some kudos to the host for asking. I think it was Peter, the same guy that interviewed Richard Gates.
No, it was Greta Broder who asked him. I remember
Greta. Greta was.
She was the coolest. She was the coolest of them all.
Right, she was good. At any rate, yeah, she asked him the Jarita Freddie. He had to say no. But he still says, that's a fake story, he says. So he would know. The guy is actually he's a criminal. Duncan Hunter is a criminal. Mm-hmm. Okay, and he's gonna tell us that you're lying, even though he didn't read the report. It's ridiculous on its face. And we're dealing with some people like that. There's also a lot of people who don't know or they believe it's just too big and it is a divide and conquer thing without having mainstream media, you're probably not going to get too far. That's part of the problem.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what, you know, there's some control. There has to be some control of the media because this should be in the media. It was surprising that Gerardo Rivera had us on. However, I think the reason he had Bob McElwain and I on back in November 2010 is that was shortly after the families of victims, 9/11 victims, put a commercial on all over New York TV about Building 7. And It's obvious on its face that it's a controlled demolition when it comes down, even with the horizon, and it's in free fall. And they were saying that. Gerardo had shown the Zapruder film in March of 1975 that showed John F. Kennedy's head going back and to the left when we were being told he shot for the right rear. So I think Gerardo says, well, I broke this Zapruder film, maybe I could break this. So he had us on. But then the story died. Nobody picked it up.
Yep. Well, we're not going to let the story die here. And we are at the end of the hour. So, Tony, it's always fun talking to you, either on the
show. It went by pretty quick, Andy. I'm surprised.
Yeah. No, it always does for me, too. But thank you so much for the work you've done, for stepping forward and appearing in these documentaries, and, of course, for coming on the show tonight.
Right. Well, I can say with the video now, you look great. You really do.
Thank you.
Great. So I couldn't all say right. that on just the radio, right?
Well, $30 for black curtains. That's what that'll do right there.
is that right?
$30 at Walmart.
Okay.
So thank you very much.
Okay. Nice being here. See you now.
All right, so that's the end of another show. Remember, we want to hear your ideas and your suggestions. So if you have them, just go to 911freefall.com. There's a contact box right on that page. But for my part, I'm Andy Steele, saying I'll see you next week. Bye-bye.
This program is on every Thursday night on No Lies Radio at 10 o'clock Eastern, 7 o'clock Pacific, and every other Sunday night on BBS Radio at 8 o'clock Eastern, 5 o'clock Pacific. You can also keep track of the archives by going to 911freefall.com. This is Andy Steele. Have a great week. Good luck.